Welcome to the Crimson Thread. I'm John Behrens, pastor of Restoration Messianic Fellowship in the Boulder-Longmont area of northern Colorado. Our website is crimsonthread.com. This study was recorded during our normal Tuesday evening Bible study. Enjoy the study. Act chapter 15 last time, Council of Jerusalem. Paul and Silas heading off on another missionary trip. I'm sort of going to speed through this missionary trip stuff. There are a couple things that I want to talk about, but basically most of it is just a list of the places they went, which is important. I mean, God wrote it in the Bible, so it's important, but I don't have anything special to say about it. So rather than drag through all of that, I'm going to sort of skip. So we're now in chapter 16. He comes to Derbe and Lystra, and there he meets Timothy, the son of a Jewish woman who was a believer, but his father was a Greek. He was well spoken of by the brothers at Lystra and Iconium. Paul wanted Timothy to accompany him, and he took him and circumcised him because of the Jews who were in those places, for they all knew that his father was a Greek. This is going to be one of the major subjects in the book of Galatians. The question of whether or not Gentiles need to be circumcised. And of course, the Council of Jerusalem, which we just finished, said no, they don't. So remember, the Council of Jerusalem basically gave them four things, which are, let me go back up and read them. Abstain from what has been sacrificed to idols, and from blood, and from what has been strangled, and from sexual immorality. If you keep them yourselves from these, you will do well. The four things we're talking about here are obviously food sacrifice to idols, and it was the custom in that part of the world at that time that you could go into a butcher shop and buy an otherwise clean animal, in other words, a goat or a cow or a sheep or so forth, and it's very likely that it would have been sacrificed to one of the local gods that day or the day before. So the idea that animals were sacrificed and then they showed up in the marketplace, Paul talks about that rather extensively in both Romans and Corinthians, I believe. And basically what he says is, if the butcher shop owner says, "This is a really great piece of lamb. It was just sacrificed to somebody this morning," then you can't eat it. But you're not required to go into the butcher shop and inquire of the pedigree of the animal. If you go in there and say, "I need a hunk of sheep," and the guy says, "Here's your hunk of sheep," you're under no obligation whatsoever to figure out what the sequence of that guy was. So that's sort of thing one. And then blood, we talked about extensively last time, and when it says blood, there's a couple of things going on there. Thing one is, it is common in Gentile countries to consume blood. So when I was in Germany, stationed over there in the army, you could go down to a butcher shop and buy bloodwurst, blood sausage, blood pudding, all those things. There's that aspect of blood. But there is also the aspect of blood having to do with the laws of Nida, which are the laws having to do with women. And it isn't clear what's being spoken about here, but I suspect that what's being said is, in order for you to go into the synagogue and hear Moses read, you've got to have certain standards of behavior. And we talked last time that it would be a real major faux pas for a woman in her menses to come up and give the rabbi a big hug. Okay, that would just not be done. So the thing about blood includes both consuming blood and handling blood as it applies to the laws of Nida. Then things strangled. Jewish way of killing animals is to cut their throats and bleed them out. In other words, the idea is, as soon as you kill an animal, it should be bled. It should not die with its blood in it, quote unquote. So the idea of not eating something that's been strangled. If an animal has been strangled, it has died with its blood in it. You can't get it to bleed out properly. And then the final thing is, of course, sexual immorality. When Paul down here in 16, notice it doesn't say anything about circumcision, and you all remember from last time that the big question that was before the council was, do we have these Gentiles become circumcised and order them to follow the laws of Moses? That none of that is mentioned in that letter. So now we're down in 16, which is where we started, and notice Paul, who is going to write the letter to the Galatians, saying, basically, you stupid Galatians, what makes you think you got to be circumcised? Or words to that effect. Yet he goes ahead and circumcises Timothy. He will furthermore say, I think in Galatians also, but certainly someplace else, that he had two young men that were his disciples. One was Titus and the other was Timothy. Titus he did not circumcise, Timothy he did. And his reason for it is that Timothy is of Jewish extraction. So the fact that his dad had not circumcised him, for him to be suitable to go with Paul, he did have to be circumcised. The stated reason there is because he was going to go to synagogues, and it's known that Timothy is, in fact, a Jew, and for Timothy then not to be circumcised would be a hindrance to the ministry. Full stop. I also believe that even if nobody had known Timothy's pedigree, that Paul would have had him circumcised anyway once Paul became aware of his pedigree. When we talk Galatians, one of the things that lots of Sunday Christians will fetch up into Galatians and say basically that the law is null and void now. Galatians can be read that way. I don't read it that way, but lots of people do. So this business about circumcision, dietary laws, laws of Nida, all these kinds of questions that come up in a Hebrew community, the question becomes, if you're a Gentile, how much of that applies to you? And there are some things that are covenantal. In other words, God says, if you are a Hebrew, this is part of the covenant and you need to do them. You know, Shabbat, circumcision, etc. There are other things that are, how would I describe it? This is the way my universe works. In other words, things like generosity, things like not murdering, things like not lying. What God has told the Hebrew people is, this is the manual for the universe that I have created. I have created a moral universe. This is how it works. And it works for Hebrews as well as for Gentiles. The Hebrews have a tremendous advantage because they have a rule book. And you know, the way I describe that is you could take your teenage son and say, all right, kid, go out there and play football. And he goes running out into the middle of the field and gets creamed by a 200-pound linebacker because he didn't have any idea what's going on. God's moral universe is like that 200-pound linebacker. If you don't know what the rules are, you can get creamed running across a football field and not paying attention. And that's what most of the Torah is. There's also some stuff that's covenantal with the Hebrews. And what the letter from the Jerusalem Council says is, basically, this is sort of the minimum stuff to come in and listen to Moses read, but there are some things that are not required under any circumstance. Notice I said required. In fact, if you go to Aish, Aish.com, A-I-S-H.com, and it's a Jewish website with a strong anti-missionary bent. Their focus is, we want to keep Jews Jews by teaching them the beauty of the Torah so that they will not get picked off by Christian missionaries. And if you go there, which is fine, just be aware that their perspective is anti-missionary. In other words, they do not believe, there are hundreds of rabbis that write there, but the purpose of the site is to prevent Jewish assimilation. They do not want Jews to become Christians, and they want to reacquaint them with the beauty of the Torah so that Christianity is not tempting. That's the reason the site exists. Now, within that, there are perspectives, you know, just like in the Christian church, all over the place. So you'll read, I read it all the time, every week. It's got some real great wisdom on it. It's also got some stuff that's just full of cornflakes. And you need to be able to separate that if you go there. And I'm not discouraging you. I'm just telling you what you're going to get into if you go there. Some of it will be really, really, really great. Some of it will be, where the heck did they get that? They've got a section on ICE for Gentiles. And what they say is, these are the seven Noahide laws that were given to Noah, and these are incumbent upon any civilized society. However, there is no conversion to Judaism that is necessary. In other words, a righteous Gentile who follows the Noahide laws has a place in heaven, according to the Jews. And so what the Council of Jerusalem does is says, this is what you need to do to get into the synagogue. Paul then, dealing with Timothy, deals differently with Timothy and Titus, both young men, both traveling with him. One of them he circumcises, the other one he doesn't. Now, could Titus become circumcised? Sure, if he wants to. Could he convert to Judaism? Sure, if he wants to. Is he a Hebrew? No, not unless he converts. If they decide that they want to keep the Passover, then they have to be circumcised. It specifically says the native-born and the sojourner. He may keep the Passover as soon as all his males are circumcised. Can we go back to Acts now? Paul does circumcise Timothy, and then he wants to go to across the Dardanelles and into the Crimea, and gets told not to. From there, he gets a vision in the middle of the night to go to Macedonia. Again, I'm not going to read all of this. Sets sail from Tros, which is basically northern Turkey by the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles up there. Goes to Samothrace. From there to Philippi, which is where he plants a church. Let's pick it up at 1611. So setting sail from Tros, they made a direct voyage to Samothrace, and the following day to Neapolis, and from there to Philippi, which is a leading city in the district of Macedonia and a Roman colony. If you go to the east side of the Greek peninsula up against the European mainland, that's where Macedonia is. We remained in this city some days, and on the Sabbath day we went outside the gate to the riverside, where we supposed there was a place of prayer, and we sat down and spoke to the women who had come together. I have no idea what's going on there. Don't know why they're gathering there or anything like that. Don't know why it's mostly women gathered there. 14. One who heard us was a woman named Lydia from the city of Thyatira, a seller of purple goods, who was a worshiper of God. The Lord opened her heart to pay attention to what was said by Paul, and after she was baptized in her household as well, she urged us, saying, "If you have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come to my house and stay." And she prevailed upon us. Purple goods could be any number of things. This woman is apparently not a Jew, so it may be a seller of dyes. Just don't know. Verse 16, as they were going to the place of prayer, we were met by a slave girl who had a spirit of divination and brought her owners much gain by fortune telling. She followed Paul and us, crying out, "These men are servants of the Most High God who proclaim to you the way of salvation." And this she kept doing for many days. Paul, having become greatly annoyed, turned and said to the Spirit, "I command you in the name of Yeshua Messiah to come out of her." And it came out that very hour. A couple of things. First off, this gal had a real live, genuine, 100%, 14 karat demon. And that demon was able to tell her things that were not visible in the natural. So she's got an unclean spirit, and that spirit knows things that are not knowable in the natural and would speak through this gal and tell people what they wanted to hear or what they hoped to hear, but it's a real deal. She is not card shark, you know, people who do tarot cards and stuff like that, who can basically deal any way they want to. This is the real thing, which is, by the way, why God in the Torah says don't mess with that stuff, because some percentage of them are charlatans, and in that sense are, won't take anything from you except your money, but some of them are the real deal. You can get hooked up with unclean spirits in a heartbeat. So anyway, Paul finally has it right up to here with this little gal and turns around and slaps her demon into the dry places. 19. But when her owners saw that their hope of gain was gone, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace before the rulers. And when they had brought them to the magistrate, they said, "These men are Jews, and they are disturbing our city. They advocate customs that are not lawful for us as Romans to accept or practice." The crowd joined in attacking them, and the magistrates tore the garments off them and gave orders to beat them with rods. And when they had inflicted many blows upon them, they threw them into prison, ordering the jailer to keep them safely. Having received the order, he put them into the inner prison and fastened their feet in stocks. This is sort of prototypical of what everybody is going to accuse them of. It's going to be sedition, which is to say they are teaching us and telling us to do things that are not lawful for a Roman to do. When the Jews come after them, they will basically do a twist on this, which says they are teaching that there is some other king but Caesar. The hook that gets them into the Roman legal system, which is where they want to be, is that these people are preaching sedition. There was a cult of Caesar. In the Roman Empire, starting, I think, with Augustus, the Roman Senate deified his father, which makes the emperor the son of God. It's a formal title. And later on in the Roman Empire, not at this point, but later on, it became a loyalty test. I don't remember, once or twice a year, you had to go to some temple. Didn't matter which one. You could go to Jupiter or Diana or Athena or anybody you wanted. And you had to offer a pinch of incense to Caesar. So you had to sacrifice to Caesar. Later on in the empire, they had these little labelli, which means little book, and everybody had to carry one of these. And when you went into the temple to sacrifice your pinch of incense, the local priest there basically stamped your book like a passport and said, "All right, this guy has offered his sacrifice to Caesar for the year, for the 6 months or however long it was." You had to carry this with you, and if you were a Roman citizen, Jews were exempt, by the way, but everybody else had to offer this pinch of incense to Caesar. If you didn't, it was regarded as treason, and the punishment was crucifixion. The practice of offering incense was, in fact, alive and well at the time Paul was writing. The bit with the little books, I think, came later, by a couple of hundred years. So, for Paul and Silas to be teaching that, A, there is only one Son of God and he isn't Caesar, and B, that offering incense to Caesar is idolatry, would certainly qualify. Now, I don't know that that's what they were specifically talking about, but it could have been something like that. 16:25. About midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the prisoners were listening to them. And suddenly there was a great earthquake, so that the foundation of the prisons were shaken, and immediately all the doors were open and everyone's bonds were unfastened. When the jailer awoke and saw that the prison doors were open, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself, supposing that the prisoners had escaped. But Paul cried out with a loud voice, "Do not harm yourself, for we are all here." We saw earlier on where Peter was in a Herodian jail, and when the Spirit let Peter out, Herod then went and killed all the jailers. So the penalty for a jailer not doing his duty and being able to produce either a prisoner or a corpse on demand was obviously very severe, and so severe that the jailer decided he was going to do it himself rather than have it done to him by the courts or the police or the king, because I suspect that having it done to you by them involved scourging and all sorts of other stuff like that, in addition to just killing you. So the jailer says, you know, heck with that. If I'm going to die, I'd just as soon die by my own hand and skip the formalities. 29. And the jailer called for lights and rushed in, and trembling with fear, he fell down before Paul and Silas. Then he brought them out and said, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" And they said, "Believe in the Lord Yeshua, and you will be saved, you and your household." And they spoke the word of the Lord to him and to all who were in his house. And he took them the same hour of the night and washed their wounds, and he was baptized at once, he and his family. Then he brought them up into the house and set food before them, and he rejoiced along with his entire household that he had believed in God. But when it was day, the magistrate sent the police, saying, "Let these men go." And the jailer reported these words to Paul, saying, "The magistrates have sent to let you go. Therefore, come out now and go in peace." But Paul said to them, "They have beaten us publicly, uncondemned men who are Roman citizens, and have thrown us into prison. And do they now throw us out secretly? No. Let them come themselves and take us out." Paul at this point recognizes that he has the upper hand, and Paul being Paul, remember, Paul's a Benjaminite, and Benjaminites are almost as starchy as Levites. Realizing that he's got these guys over the barrel, he then stands up and makes a point. 38. The police reported these words to the magistrates, and they were afraid when they heard they were Roman citizens. Later on, when Paul is arrested in Jerusalem, he stands up and says, "I'm a Roman citizen," and so gets his case transferred out of the temple court and into the Roman court. He avoids a beating and worse in Jerusalem by claiming to be a Roman citizen. Why doesn't he do so here? I just don't know the answer to that. 39. So they came and apologized to them, and they took them out and asked them to leave the city. So they went out of the prison and visit Lydia. And when they had seen the brothers, they encouraged them and departed. So basically, we can't do anything to you, but don't let the sun set on you in this town. In other words, they threw them out of town because they are, in fact, troublemakers. Somebody like to close in prayer?